Let's go, Katie.
Okay. Well, I don't think you got the last Facebook inbox that I sent you today, but I found one other simpler article that I also
read. I did.
I
didn't have to read it. I have it in my archives. I know Richard Castellanets. He is a baby boomer that in the New York art world of 67, he wrote the article for New York Times, the one you posted, and that put him on the map. And then he became a kind of a gadfly critic and put out some interesting books, celebrating McLuhan and other avant-garde thinkers at the time, Richard Castellanets. I then bumped into him about 10 years ago down at a little operation in the East Village, and he was poor and not doing too well, and so he got a few gigs printing books. He even did a book on Gerd Stern, our old buddy Gerd Stern. You can listen to 24 Hours of Gerd Stern on Dobsound.com. The ASCO group, the first electronic multimedia happening group in the mid-60s. Castellanets did a book on them. He knew Gerd and all those guys. He did these books up through the 80s, 90s, but then an art critic from New York City had no more clout once the Android meme came in, or the After Image in 1995, and Richard may not even be still alive. Though he did do a book, a collected book on essays on Frank Zappa. He did do that. That matches my chart. He got his name with McLuhan, and then 40 years later, wrapped up his career with a book on Zappa, which is in that same quadrant.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Go ahead. There are just a few little points in here. I don't want to go through the whole thing. I liked it. This would be a great primer to give someone. It's well written, and it's simply written, and it covers McLuhan in breadth. You know, it's a good overview. Yeah. In fact, I would give this to somebody now before the Playboy interview because it's simpler.
Yeah.
But I found it because I was actually looking for where the Psychopathology of Time and Life had been published, because I read that from the pictures that you had taken of the book and posted, and I don't know where that was published. So that's how I came across this McLuhan, or this Castellanets article. And
that was Katie. So you're saying that you wanted to find that article and looking for the time Psychopathology of Time and Life. You came across the Castellanets article.
Correct.
Well, that's good serendipity.
Yep.
I will now tell you the book. The book is called The Scene Before You, A New Approach to American Culture, and it is 1955. What's interesting about this book, you don't have the Beatniks yet. Sputnik is still to come in 2 years. You got Elvis, or at least Blackboard Jungle in 55. Things are starting to bubble in the United States. It's after the big change in 1953. Stalin has died. The old order's out. Britain is useless. And so now America can strut its stuff. So here's these guys. This is like a Richard. Now, this is interesting. Chandler Brosshead, he edited this book. And it's the kind of book that Richard Castellanets would do. Castellanets would go around and get all the intellectuals of the day, professors, artists, and whatever, and get them to write essays and then put out a book. So this is called The Scene Before You, A New Approach to American Culture. So this is where people, it's the idea of where it's at, you know. What is happening with television? People had a new sense of speed up, and they want to know where they were sociologically. What's our image? What's our icon? Are we getting bored with Eisenhower? Is Nixon a jerk, you know? So The Scene Before You. So he has articles like this is one of the Manny Farber. Movies aren't movies anymore. He's always complaining about the effect of TV. Milton Klonsky, Greenwich Village, Decline and Fall. Now that's all going to be revitalized by Dylan and the folk culture in the late 50s, a few years later. And then Seymour Krim says, our middle-aged young writers in quotes. And I haven't read that yet. And then Don Hagar writes about the rhetoric of intergroup liberalism. Bernard Wolfe, ecstatic in blackface. Heinz Pulitzer, from Little Nemo to Little Abner. Now, remember how McLuhan wrote about Little Abner in Mechanical Bride? Then you go down Norman Potteritz, who was a straight critic at that point, very sort of hanging out with Norman Mailer, but he becomes a reactionary by 1961, and he writes a book about his trying to be hip in the 50s called Making It, and then he becomes a leader of the neoconservative backlash that supported Nixon, everybody, in the late 60s, early 70s. Yes, that's a little tired expressing yourself in the background. And Norman Podhoretz writes an article, Our Changing Ideals as Seen on TV. And right in the middle of it, Marsh McLuhan says, The Psychopathology of Time and Life. And if you read that article closely, it's the most incredible article. He's announcing we're dead and gone. The funeral wake for the human species has begun, and it's being managed by very sinister people. And he wrote that in 1949. And that the magazine it was in, Neurotica, went out of business. I think it had a scandal. And G.R. Legman, I think, ran it. Got in trouble for some pornography. And then...
What was it?
So,
Neurotica?
Neurotica. Yeah. Erotica, Neurotica. And that's a good magazine. And that's 49. And then this guy, what's his name? Chandler Brossard, retrieved the article for 1955. And that's where that book is. So, the scene before you. All right, Katie, back to you.
And that's what Pinchbeck did, but only with the 2012 meme. His book that we were talking about last week, he got everybody to write essays from their point of view, all the major mind calendar scholars, and
well,
put
you know
it together
what?
All
that's
in
what
one
that,
book.
That's what a lot. That's what all that college professors do. Been doing it for about 30
mm-hmm.
years. They get together among their colleagues in a certain specialty and do a book, a panel almost. That's where my book, Fatty Communion with Bob Dobbs, is a panel satirizing the panelistic characteristic of culture by the 80s where people are doing this kind of stuff, the scene before you, and putting their fellow friends and professors on site. The only way they get a book published is through an edited collection. And it's also a very important point here in this same book, is an essay by Clement Greenberg, and it's called American Type Painting. So he's talking about the abstract expressionism of Jackson Pollock, and he is the antidote to McLuhan. And my friend Shoki went on 10 years ago to write a PhD, like 5 years ago, a PhD about McLuhan versus Greenberg, Clement Greenberg, in the art world. And it's not known much about that debate, that argument, but it's a hidden ground. And here, this book has McLuhan and Greenberg both in the book. So if Greenberg had not heard of McLuhan before, he would have seen that, oh, McLuhan's in this. Who is this McLuhan Canadian guy? So that prefaces something. Okay, back to you.
Okay, there's just a couple of things that I liked in the Constellanitz article that I wanted to talk about. And then I do want to move on and talk about the psychopathology of time and life in detail. But when we were talking last week about evolution with regard to the alphabet and the goddess and how much of the anthropology that Leonard Schlain had brought into his book and how, you know, Ion doesn't really talk about that and what Marshall might think of that. And this article talked about, I mean, Marshall thought that technology was what was guiding our evolution. That's
yeah.
what I got out of this article. I mean, you've probably said that to me before. It's fun this week because this first article, the Constellanitz one, is a survey, and it's a simple survey. And then I read Psychopathology of Time and Life, and when we get to that, I had in mind that it was published in 1949, Mechanical Bride in 1951, and I read enough McLuhan that as I read this now, I can see all of his allusions to Wyndham Lewis.
Yeah.
I can see there's pieces of, I mean, even the pantyhose in Mechanical
yeah.
Bride appear in this article. Like,
yeah.
I can see everything foreshadowed because it was before his first book. And then
No. What the book was pretty well finished by 48, 49, and the publisher.
But it wasn't.
Yeah, the book comes out in 51.
The public is read right, and so but this
right.
is, and this article was published in 49, 2 years before Mechanical Bride came out. But this alludes to many of the themes in the Bride.
Yes, it's an ad for his. It's an ad for his approach. Yeah, it's an
and they're really teasers. You can see
yes.
them, and then
yeah, yeah.
And so it's neat to look at that. It's like watching the Godfather movies backwards. That's how I felt about that.
Right.
And then to read some feel for this week that is like another survey but going into such depth. Yeah, it's just been a neat, it's been a neat buffet. But, and so my point is, too, I think you probably said some of these things before, and like maybe I didn't hear it, or it didn't stick. I have been
okay, let me address
thoughts.
The evolution thing.
Sure.
And I'm going to say something and see what's in the article. He says in Counterblast 1969 that biological evolution had finished and technology took over man's evolution. So then he found a quote around that time by Hans Simeon, a scientist or something. I think his book is called Man's Presumptuous Brain. And he technically says that the evolution in our bodies, our brain and bodies, had stopped, you know, millions of years ago. And as new technologies were invented, the technologies were what the biological brain could not handle. And that led to all kinds of cultural problems. It was the new human-made technologies or second nature that were causing the problems for the old biological brain, which couldn't adapt anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a pretty neat idea. So then what did he say in Castellanet's article?
Castellanet presents it far more simply than what you just said. He just says that, I don't want to read the whole thing. In looking at history, McLuhan espouses a position one can only call technological determinism. That is, whereas Karl Marx, an economic determinist, believed that the economic organization of a society shapes every important aspect of its life, McLuhan believes that crucial technological inventions are the primary influence. And then he goes on to talk about Lynn White and the three inventions, the stirrup, the nailed horseshoe, and the horse collar, created in the Middle Ages, and how that changed everything and shaped the feudal system. So Castellanet just mentions it briefly and coins the term technological determinism, but what you just said is far richer. And that's really all he says.
Let me respond to that.
Sure.
See, this is January 67. The Medium is the Massage does not come out for a couple more months, I think. The album comes out a little later. McLuhan is not on the cover of magazines yet. Maybe he was in Newsweek in 66, but the explosion of McLuhanism in the media, Madison Avenue, McLuhan, we call it, is a little later. But so Castellanet is jumping ahead. It's almost like the New York Times set the agenda for 67. And not many people knew about McLuhan. They were struck by the originality of these ideas, and they would sort of think, oh, technological determinism, that's interesting. But within a couple of years, all the critics jump on McLuhan for being a technological determinist. But it's not a bad term in this article is probably written late 66. It's not a bad term at the beginning of McLuhan's career in the major popular media. But it becomes the very thing that McLuhan has to defend or talk around from that point on, from 68, 69. It's terrible to be a technological determinist, people say. So just giving a bit of the background, it's interesting that...
Why is it terrible? I don't understand. Why is it terrible?
Because people want to believe the humanist idea of human agency causes reality, causes changes. You know, like Ion would not agree with technological determinism, but he says we are not very good at being human agency, so we're by default technologically determined. And that was McLuhan's point, too. It wasn't a fact that you could not overcome technology. McLuhan was trying to wake people up to their somnambulism. And
here's a quote that illustrates that, and this is a good one. And like, when we've talked about the maelstrom all these weeks, too, I didn't get how serious Marshall was about that. Like, he was giving that, it's why it keeps coming up over and over and over in such a variety of contexts, is because that approach is what he thought would save us from technological determinism.
Yeah.
So this quote that I really liked, and it's several pages later in the article, to prevent this latter possibility, McLuhan insists that every man should know as much about the media as possible, and this is quoting Marshall, By knowing how technology shapes our environment, we can transcend its absolutely determining power, he says. Actually, rather than a technological determinist, it would be more accurate to say, as regards to the future, that I'm an organic autonomist. My entire concern is to overcome the determinism that results from the determination of people to ignore what is going on. Far from regarding technological change as inevitable, I insist that if we understand its components, we can turn it off anytime we choose. Short of turning it off, there are lots of moderate controls conceivable. In brief, in stressing the importance of knowledge, McLuhan is a humanist.
Right. And
it's right in with what you were just saying.
Yeah, and that statement by McLuhan was never given a repeat. He did not allow that clarification to be known once McLuhan started to become a problem in 1669 and seemed to be agitating the youth, and the establishment got upset in the Canadian Parliament. The Governor General made a statement in Parliament, you know, condemning McLuhan for being a radical. He was seen as a radical and this and that. So the hallucination that happens to anybody who presents any kind of case in the media began almost around McLuhan. He might have been the first victim of the global theater of craziness and nobody really getting a handle on the facts anymore. You know what I mean? Nobody could hold a view because all the factions would start getting coverage and contradict everybody and each other. So, yeah, McLuhan was the first victim of that. Can't say, in culture terms, you could say the blacklist during the McCarthy era, that, you know, ruined people's lives. That was finger-pointing. That's, like, based on you're a communist. But in the cultural world of media and people having leisure society by the late 60s and interested in ideas, the average person, the middle class, more available to contemplate stuff and see intellectuals on talk shows and that, that led to a chaos, what Don Thiel calls the chaos most, quoting Finney's Wake. McLuhan would be probably the first victim of that. You know, he got a lot of attention in the late 60s, but within a year or two, many people were sick of him. Other people thought he was too dangerous. Others thought he was stupid. Others thought he was a genius. And it just went on and on and on. And by 1970, everybody was sick of McLuhanism. And so the greening of America, Charles Reich came in. So at that point, you started to have professors becoming the meme flavor for a six-month period or so, or a year. You know what I mean? And they got turned over. It went on and on and on, a whole bunch of them.
So that's just the sped-up nature of what the media was doing at the same time.
The media was a classroom. The professor would come in, everybody would be excited about the idea, but they wanted more ideas pretty quickly. You don't just stay around with one class, and so everybody got bored. And one time I visited McLuhan Center in 1971, and his brother, who was the front man, the front desk, told me, well, Bob, we're not going, we're not doing any talks out there. We're staying right here. We have to lay low for a while. They totally understood this process. They knew that they had to become nobodies again for a couple of years. And then McLuhan services in 74. With, remember this, he had a new interesting pattern. He's pointing out that the congestion on highways and the traffic jams in cities, what do they call that? They wanted to bring in public transportation. Everybody thought, well, it's common sense. Everybody get on the subways, they have big public transportation. And McLuhan says, no, you can't do that in America. Americans go out to be alone in their cars. It's the only time they get to think and to look at their lives and to figure out what they're doing in their jobs. They don't get privacy at home. So he said the car is not there for transportation. It's there to be put into a traffic jam so you had time to think and have privacy. So that was his uniqueness of coming up with a semi-anthropological pattern about an issue that everybody thought, oh, I just solved that with public transportation. You see what I'm saying? And I remember when he started getting quoted on that in 74, people said, uh-oh, McLuhan's back. He's making us think again. So he lay low in 71, 72, 73. But so he was always ahead of the pattern. He saw this happening to everybody else after him, and many of them came and went. That you could take the generations, the baby boomers and the Generation X and maybe the younger, every one of them, when they're in college, there'd be some intellectual that was in the media, could be Norman Mailer or somebody, that they would identify with. You know what I mean? You can go through. Mm-hmm. My chart almost shows that. Did you go to college?
Did I?
Yes.
Yes, I have a master's degree in communication and a bachelor's in English.
I never heard of McLuhan. See, that's
right.
A later thing. But he starts the field and he gets lost in the shuffle. But who was a thinker, probably a woman, that was a model for you in college, a public intellectual?
I don't know.
Jermaine Greer?
I have no idea. No, maybe Naomi Wolf.
All right, there you go. Naomi Wolf.
Okay.
That's a good example.
Yeah.
Okay. Later's Naomi Klein. And the book publishers realized that ideas were obsolete. And McLuhan used to say back in the 70s when he got on TV, businessmen are interested in ideas, which just screwed up the whole thing of intellectuals. And this book, seen before you, a bunch of intellectuals in the 50s, thinking that they're important and making a pattern and not knowing that software patterning is going to be run by business by the 70s on. And so McLuhan gets on a famous TV show, The Front Page or whatever it was called in Canada, and says, only businessmen are interested in ideas. Now, that's putting together two things that most people don't put together as ideas. Businessmen are people who are not interested in ideas, right? They're just into the cliche about them. But it'd be turned into an idea, cultures are business, is the name of McLuhan's update of Mechanical Bride. And so all the publishers knew that you create a new thinker of the year, you know, every couple of years. And then later, after feminism, a lot of them were women.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, Naomi Wolf, perfect example.
Big time feminist.
Yeah.
Boy, I would get mad when I would read her stuff. I would want to just fucking cut the heads off of every man I saw.
And what years was that? When was that happening?
That was actually like when I was out of college and working and doing my master's degree.
Yeah, you're 25 or so.
The Beauty Myth. Yeah, The Beauty Myth.
Yeah.
You know that book?
Yeah. See, the thing is, I asked you what if you had a mentor or some role model, you couldn't think of one. It's actually a part of every generation's life. They don't even know that they're an intellectual mentor. It's just someone that they would read and get involved with, and it was almost an invisible environment. And it was for you.
Mm-hmm.
No one has ever pointed this out to you, what the role of Naomi Wolf was.
No.
What was, hey, Carolyn, did you have one?
Who was that?
Adele Davis?
Oh, yeah, Adele Davis, and then that, what was the guy who put down medicine that lectured one time?
Oh, Ivan Illich.
Yeah.
Ivan Illich, he was a friend of McLuhan. He did a book called De-Schooling Society, major intellectual in the 70s, and he came and spoke in Halifax, and we went to it, and Carolyn, did he say it to you personally, or did he say it in public?
In public, not me personally.
I think someone asked about doctors, about medicine, and he said, I consider all doctors as Nazis.
Mm-hmm.
He said,
yeah.
And Carolyn said, that's probably true. I'll use that. Doctors as are Nazis. Well, that wasn't so obvious back then, but they're worse than Nazis now. They're multi-bodied, quadrophenic shapeshifters who do not have your health in mind. Did I say quadrophonic? Quadrophenic. Back to you, Katie.
Another paragraph that I thought was really interesting in this article, McLuhan advocates radical changes in education because he believes that a contemporary man is not fully literate if reading is his sole pleasure. This is foreshadowing the five bodies.
Yeah.
He must be literate in umpteen media to be really literate nowadays. Education, he suggests, should abandon its commitment to print merely by focusing on the visual sense to cultivate the total sensorium of man to teach us how to use all five cylinders. All five cylinders. Five bodies.
Yes, you're right. This is a good article. Just that quote about organic autonomous Other than that article, it's never said again. It is a good thing to introduce because a lot of the spectrum of McClellan is being expressed here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that was really the only other little paragraph, and then that's really it for this particular article. Is Marshall says at one point, I wish none of these had ever happened. He's talking about technologies, various
yes.
technologies. I wish none of these had never happened. They impress me as nothing but a disaster. They are for dissatisfied people. Why is man so unhappy he wants to change his world?
Right. Now, now that there he is in a newspaper explaining his point of view almost. His
mm-hmm.
you know, in-depth point of view, but the image of him is a guy gung-ho for TV. He likes TV. He wants everybody watching TV. It's incredible hallucination over him because he was on TV. He'd get on to talk shows and that. And the newspaper is a slower medium. And for people who had time to read, they'd find out this private self. Now, you have to also remember that Marshall's spelling out his policies, his personal agenda, in a newspaper medium. He would not say that on TV. He would not have a point of view. He'd look like a techno enthusiast in a different medium. That's what you have to realize later, that he's saying certain things for because of the medium that's listening. So he's presenting
sure,
himself as a humanist.
That's what the book is all about.
Yes, that's right. Now, Donfield does the best in explaining that. And the Enlightenment and the newspaper world brings out, creates humanism, or on a mass level, leads to nationalism, republicanism, and all that stuff, and the Enlightenment. So McLuhan is talking to the New York Times, so he hoiks up their tradition, their values, and mirrors them.
Which he was great at.
Yes. And you won't know that until you read Don Thiel.
Right. Well,
which reminds me, I wanted to ask you.
A lot.
What?
Yeah, cool. Well, you allude to that, the put on, and I mean, I think you do a lot of that. I see, after reading some Don Thiel, you're just like that. You do that
that's
too.
That's what Jerry Fialka said. He said he read the book and he said, "Bob, this is about you."
Yeah,
and
that's
course,
what I thought too.
And the funny thing is, the book opens with me. First line, Don knew that. Don knew what I was doing, and he actually said to Michael Edmonds that Bob is the inheritor of McLuhan's mantle. And that's pretty high praise from Don, because Don is the intellectual inheritor. He knows McClellan so inside out. Many of the discoveries made in the 1950s, 53 period were due to Don, you know, a 23, 24, 25-year-old. He brought Carpenter and Norbert Wiener to McClellan. And McClellan came and spent noon hour with Don and his wife every day for 3 years. So Don was there in the exciting period of understanding and cracking the code, defending his wake and all that. That's why... he's really important to read. So, okay, there was another point. You said when you first started to read, I think, The Virtual Marshall McLuhan, the preface made you cry or weep. What is in there? What was it?
Well, because he had a serendipitous encounter with you. I mean, it really, and it's right there in the first paragraph.
First sentence.
Yeah, first sentence.
So, oh, that makes a connection.
Yes. Well, because now I'm talking to you.
So that meant it's about you.
Well, yeah, I told you that. I'll be honest.
Right.
Yeah, this is really exciting to be part of.
Yes, it is. Okay.
So interesting.
So, that article.
Let me just wrap this other article up. So the only other last thing that I will say is he does briefly allude to the artist, because, you know, we're going to get into that at length in the Thiel piece, but the artist is the man in any field, scientific or humanistic, who grasps the implications of his actions and of new knowledge in his own time. He is the man of integral awareness. What he's saying is that most people are alive in an earlier time, but you have to be alive in your own time. And an artist is one who can do that and often do it in a way that those around him cannot.
That's right.
And then, that was, we will get into this in the field book, but of course that was Marshall's whole thing, was to be a poetic prophet.
Yes, and to notice the present. He knew that technology was the key. You know, 100 years before that, you had to be a real extreme genius to notice the technical ground to the cultural dynamic. But he, McLuhan would say by the end of the, well, halfway through the 20th century, had so many technological turnovers, you could start to see the pattern that the common for social wisdom, the common agency of change, was a new medium. So now it is common sense today, and the Evergreen said a very interesting thing. The difference between the Middle Eastern cultures, you know, this war we're at, was it the Battle of Civilizations, Samuel Huntington called it, the Middle East civilizations, they know the change is inevitable. They want it slower. The North American knows that change is inevitable and actually demands it to happen faster. So that's what the war across the planet is. One culture knows the medium is the message, but wants to ignore that and just wallow in everything new thing as soon as possible. Whereas the older cultures, the less industrialized cultures in the Middle East, are media ecologists. And they want to say, take a little time. Don't dump all this new technology on us immediately and wipe out our background. So they're living at a slower level. So they are actually McLuhanites, and that's the battle. It's Tim Leary versus McLuhan. If you think of Tim Leary as a guy who's saying, let's get the latest drugs and go forward and keep stoning ourselves, that's the West, and we're fighting against the Marshall McLuhanites, known as Arabs, who are saying, hey, slow down. Now, that's what the Evergreens pointed out, 15 years ago. So that's a good pattern. Everybody knows you can't stop technology now.
No. And why, I was thinking too, why did all this stuff take place in Canada? Like, why? Because it is. I mean, McLuhan
had a statement about
Guinness
that.
Guinness was in Canada. You're in Canada. I'm secretly Canadian. My parents are Canadian. They are. My dad
is that right?
In the Sioux. Yeah. I'm the first American. Everybody else is Canadian. Yeah.
What Most part of Canada?
To St. Marie, Ontario.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah,
the curling team from the Sioux just won the curling medal.
Yeah. Yeah, I just want, is that that woman that Linus goes on about? The women, did they win the, let me look, Jones or somebody, Linus is going on about her earlier this week. She led the Canadian team. Did they win? Mm-hmm. Did they win a gold?
In curling, yes.
Right, but you talking about men's curling in Sault Ste. Marie?
Yes, I'm talking about men's curling in Sault Ste. Marie. Yeah. And my grandpa was a curler.
Hmm. So the Canadians won both men and women?
I don't know. You have to clarify that. I think
look at Ronan says, all part of Bobby's easier with a cooler against the curler. Is that true? I'm not a cooler. I'm a routine. I'm a technological liberal. I keep my, what I am... hidden. I helped LaRouche get started. 66 years. Who funded it? We took Delhi, one of the biggest terrorists that ever came out of the restaurant in the 40s. I don't know me, read the damn fucking diaries. The most stupid statement of Obama or the McLuhan Party. As McLuhan said, if I talk about something, I'm probably against it. So if I'm known to be talking about McLuhan all these years, then you probably know I'm against McLuhan. But we don't make it obvious. We know what it is you. We know what you need to know about it. It's just kidding. But back to your Canadian thing, McLuhan had a good comment about that. He said that, and you know what, this shit was back in the 50s, early 60s. Canadians have a sort of philosophical detachment in relation to American juggernaut that was starting to go around the world, American pop culture, movie stars, music, and everything. And he says, because we're beside it, we get the first exposure to it, but we're not part of the culture. We don't get drafted. We don't have to deal with all that stuff that the service of technology that tears American society apart. The Canadians are a little more reserved and detached. So that's why all the good comedy, the smart comedy comes out of Canada, because they're an involved and detached position, both involved and detached, and they're removed because they're not drafted. Yeah, just say that. They're not drafted. So the Canadians have a nationally detached view in relation to American culture. And so what happens in these meetings is that Margaret Atwood and a lot of other writers, Mike Lindacci and Rothbard, and poets Leonard Cohen, they became popular all over the world, and it was known as Ken Lit. Ken Lit. Mm-hmm. Did they teach you that in your English courses? That you hear that phrase, Ken Lit?
No, I read Margaret Atwood.
Right. So the Canadian professors were very proud of Ken Lit, and the reason it became popular is that people around the world could get the advantage. They were really next door to the United States. Everybody was in the global theater. They're right beside American culture. It's like they're not physical, right beside them, invading their culture. It was only Canada that had this philosophical detachment by being a part of North America, but not politically closely involved. So the novels, the writers, the movies, had a certain detached pace to them that the rest of the world liked. You know what I mean? It was Perseus's mirror that held up against the Gorgon. You know, Perseus held the mirror up to the monster. If he looked at the monster, he'd be frozen. But if he looked at the monster in the mirror, in the hand mirror, then he would survive and would not get hypnotized. So Canlit is the mirror held up by the global consumer of culture, Perseus, against the American Gorgon, which was the name for Mechanical Bride at one point, as well as Typhon. McLuhan started off calling Mechanical Bride a monster.
Oh. Does the Canadian thing have anything to do with the fact that the broadcasting is government-owned, like the BBC? So if they wanted to shut it off, they could? Whereas in America, it's all... Is that part of it, too?
Now, McLuhan was not for Canada politically. He was interviewed, had a big story in Life magazine in 1966, and he said, if Canadians would just stop being a Canadian and allow themselves to be absorbed into America, they would be showered with gifts. Now, that was an outrageous thing for a Canadian to say, because right around that time, Canadians are starting to get nervous, and they're looking for a new charismatic image, so they bring in Trudeau to counter the dull Diefenbaker, Lester Pearson politicians, but also the Quebecers want to separate, and Canadian nationalism starts moving up with people like Mel Watkins, I think his name was. So they hated McLuhan saying we should just give up our national boundaries and subsume ourselves in America, but McLuhan knew that you couldn't stop the effect of American globalization, so why be a phony and pretend you're resisting it? But nobody with their literate identities could adopt that stance. So he was not a Canadian locally. When he went back to Canada in 1944, he said, I'm going back to Canada to rip off its hide. He stated that. But he actually was just trying to avoid the draft. He was at the point where he could have been drafted into World War II, so he got the hell out of the country. And Don Thiel went to Canada for the same reason, to avoid the Korean War. So media colleges are wimps. They're draft dodgers. They cannot be patriots.
And so Life magazine published this article on him?
Oh, yeah, it's a great article. Yeah, Google it.
In what year?
February 66.
After he said what? After he said what he said in Psychopathology of Time and Life?
Yes.
Evidently, that article.
Psychopathology is the 40s. TV changes. McLuhan, when I read that part of that Psychopathology to Dennis Young when he's on a few weeks ago, and it may have been in the unrecorded part, but he definitely said, holy wow, that's not McLuhan. McLuhan's not hard-edged like that. He's not so blatantly, you know, opinionated or pissed off as that. And he was right. That was the pre-TV, that was the hot McLuhan, as opposed to the cool McLuhan, who people who knew McLuhan in the hot phase in the 40s, 50s, were shocked at McLuhan in the 60s. They thought he'd gone nuts. He was like, who has done this? It's like Jerry Rubin leading the hippies and yippies and then suddenly becoming a new age networker, you know? He shocked people. He switched to radically. McLuhan, everybody thought McLuhan was having an identity crisis and just giving up and joining the corporate society and becoming a propagandist. And it's only Don Thiel who unteases all those confusions about McLuhan.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's talk about the Psychopathology of Time and Life. Are you ready?
Just before we do it, there is a couple of comments. You should hear your reviews.
Yeah.
Let's see. Sarah Courtney says, Bob and Katie is done by Zappa or Dave. Now, there may be some noise factor going on the radio. I have to go way back here. Ion turned Bob into a robot talking about... Look, man, I've been a robot on that point for 30 years. Matter of fact, this is my anniversary year. 1984 was my first time on the radio, October 1st, and here it is, 30 years later. Still saying the same thing.
Finish the comment. You laughed. Finish the comment. You laughed and you didn't let us enjoy it with you. What's the comment? There's Bob talking like a robot.
Yeah, Goran says, Ion turned Bob into a robot talking about technology. This is ridiculous. We're only talking about this because Katie is loving her inner robot and just learning to get to know it. That's why we're doing this stuff. Right, Katie? You've discovered your
domo
inner
robot. Arigato, Mr. Roboto. Domo, domo.
Yeah. Who did that?
It was me.
No, I mean, who are you quoting? Who are you quoting?
It was that song. I don't know. Someone might know.
Yeah, there's so many posts. There's so many posts I can't even. Yeah, say it.
I don't. It's that song. Thank you, Mr. Robot. Domo arigato.
I think
it's
Sticks.
Is it Sticks? Oh my God, it's from The Grand Illusion. Yeah.
The Grand Illusion.
Thanks, Bart. Thanks, Bart.
Yeah. Now, Bart. Apparently, we are the reverb is happening to our voices for some people's computers. That's why they think this is being done by Zappa or Dave Neufeld. So, sorry about the reverb. We're not getting it. You got to all phone in and get inside here, and then you won't get the reverb, right?
Yeah,
right? That's the solution.
Yeah, there are those effects. There are those effects on the outside. I hear them on the archives, and you guys aren't aware of them a lot of the time.
Right. And everybody note, I'm checking the phone numbers to see if anybody significant is calling in. Nobody yet. W. Cummings. We have a caller from Croatia. Let's just acknowledge him. We don't want him to interrupt us because we have to go through translation crap and, you know, the cultural dissonance. And they're still back in 1973 or something, right? So go ahead, Katie. Forget the commentary. It's they're all missing everything because it's distorted. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, so tell me why you think this is the greatest article of the 20th century, Bob.
Because
the psychopathology of time and life.
All right, so I'm opening it up.
Mm-hmm.
I've got the book here, the original book, which is proof that I am 92 years old to have this book from 1950, 60 years ago, right?
Right.
It's back when books were dinky. It's amazing how the big the print was and not that many pages and articles. I mean, one page of a Thomas Pynchon novel has more words than five pages of these books. So there it is. So trying to find the sentence, but he basically says that humanity is gone, and there's an afterimage of humanity, which is propped up by time, life, and fortune. You know, Henry Luce's images. And he comes in to tell. This is way beyond the way ahead of William Burroughs.
So I know where the quote is. Here's the quote. And nobody will find either human dimensions, human order, or human complexity. No, that's not it.
That's good enough. But where is that? What part of the?
That's on page 148, right in the middle of the big paragraph that starts that page out.
All right. So let me read that. But like North. Yeah. Go ahead.
No. He's just saying, I think, how time, life, and fortune are so appealing to us because...
No, this is you found a good paragraph. So the third paragraph of the article, he says, I may as well say at once that I don't think that the Henry Luce brain can do it. Mr. Luce, maybe we should read the paragraph before. Let's just read the first
three paragraphs.
Well,
he's talking about adding a fourth magazine to the triumvirate that he already has.
Time wasn't before. He's going to make one for the people interested in art and the intellectual stuff. And they were called clerks in the 20s, C-L-E-R-C-S. It's a great book, Julian Benda, talks about the betrayal of the clerks, and those are the intellectuals of the 20s, 30s. You know, the right said they all went left, and left said they went all right. Everybody was unhappy, so unhappy.
Is it clerics? Clerics?
Clerks, French word, C-L-E-R-C-S, clerks.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But everybody was so unhappy in the 30s that they built a bomb to nuke each other. They had a war over it. So he says, the problem for Mr. Luce. Yes.
Bob, let's just state who we're talking about. Henry Luce is a publishing magnate, and he published Time, Life, and Fortune. That's pretty impressive.
He's a very powerful man.
So Marshall's pretty much calling him an idiot right now.
Yes. He is the leader. He is the leader of the 1984 scenario of George Orwell. Orwell's writing about 1934 in 1948. So 1984 is about 1934, according to McLuhan, and that's at the heyday of Time, Life, and Fortune, and they dominated. They created the iconography for people's lives, and people loved it. They didn't know that they were being eaten alive by this photography.
No.
They thought it was just nice, wonderful pictures, right?
Right.
Great stuff.
Absolutely. Yep.
Right.
Okay, go on.
So he says... So now Luce wants to make a magazine for intellectuals. And let's see. But the problem for Mr. Luce is first to reduce the present role of art and letters to a simple pattern, like he does in Time, Life, and Fortune, which could be reproduced monthly without disturbing the existing affinities between his other three magazines. So he's saying that Luce will have to make a real simple, dumbed-down People magazine kind of version of intellectual magazine, right? So he's saying that's what he has to do, or that's what he wants to do. He says, but, I'll read one more sentence. That problem solved, he could probably buy up quite a crowd of betraying intellectuals for his new job. So he thought there'd be McLuhan's saying there's lots of intellectuals who would gladly go along with that. All right? They want to participate in the wealth of the 50s. This is what many lefties said, that the working class was bought off by the suburban abundance of the 50s. So the intellectuals would be bought off. But McLuhan says it can't be done. I may as well say at once that I don't think the Luce brain can do it. Now, Marshall became a close friend of Henry Luce's widow in the 70s anyways. Claire Booth Luce had a place here in Hawaii, and McLuhan stayed with her. So she was very influential politically. So it's interesting that McLuhan is hanging out with Claire years later after Luce has died, after Luce has taken LSD, and that probably fucked him up and he died. So, but back in the 49, Mr. Luce is king. Mr. Luce has a passion for glossy mediocrity and stereotypical order, which derives from his obsession with mechanism. So this is where McLuhan is beginning to point out that this is a visually biased guy, a kinetic biased guy, you know, if you talk in later media terms. But he doesn't have that perception yet. Innes hasn't, he hasn't read Innes yet. He's talking about the mechanical bride, the mechanical man, the industrial appendage, but he doesn't have the subtleties of saying acoustic man, visual man, kinetic man, tactile man yet, right? But he's saying that Luce is obsessed with the medium of his day, which McLuhan calls mechanism. Even as a young man, he must have been very fatigued because he seems to have felt very strongly all the senescent and servile appeal of the brittle and lifeless perfection of machined thoughts and feelings. Now, he's a graduate of Yale, I think, Luce, Harvard or Yale. And so McLuhan is saying these guys were so dumb as teenagers or early 20-year-olds, they actually were impressed with machined thoughts and feelings, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Luce wants the best imitation of thought and feeling that the machine can produce. See, nobody is talking about culture being this way. Maybe Adorno is in the Frankfurt School, but McLuhan's right there in the middle of popular culture doing this. And so he's saying, you're just a product of the machine. But like Northcliffe, and we see Northcliffe, he's one of these evil aristocrats from Leonardo da Vinci to Sherlock Holmes in that part of Mechanical Bride. Remember that?
Of course.
But like Northcliffe, so he's implying that Luce is actually an aristocrat by this time. he's above the middle class that are buying his magazines. But like Northcliffe, he succeeds not so much by cynical inner detachment from his Punch and Judy show. That means he's not engaging in the content that he's selling. He knows the medium is the message. The new glossy magazines are the new environment. So McLuhan's saying he's a crafty guy who's become what he beheld and knows the other people. He's not going to warn the peasants about what they're being eaten up by because he has cynical inner detachment from this media Punch and Judy show as by irremediable identity with the weary vacuum of his reader mass. Okay, Northcliffe, the aristocrat, sick of the middle class. So here's this media aristocrat, Luth. He succeeds not so much by cynical inner detachment, but by irremediable identity with the weary vacuum of his reader mass. He loves to show off the machine as much as any Hollywood director glories in camera show-off, but the machine as show-off is megalomaniac, and nobody will find either human dimensions, human order, or human complexity in time, life, or fortune, even though the masses are reading these magazines because they're anthropomorphic. They're about human beings and the ups and downs and tragedies and triumphs of humans in all kinds of industrial situations or not. And they think it's human. But McLuhan is pointing out very early there's no human dimension. Orwell didn't go that far with the 1984 scenario. These magazines are heavily farced, mechanistic fantasies of a megalomaniac kind. Now imagine you telling your reading this to your grandfather, Katie, assuming your grandfather, right, grandmother were normal, functioning Americans or Canadians in the 40s, and a guy comes up and tells you this is what time is all about. They would not understand it. McLuhan is actually describing what later is called the Matrix or virtual reality, right? Mm-hmm. This is why it's the greatest article. Mm-hmm. He is describing virtual reality 50 years before it becomes popular.
Well, there is a paragraph in the, if you go back to the New York Times article, where he actually mentions, I mean, straight up virtual reality.
Let
me see if I can find it.
The term doesn't get known until 1990, sort of.
Well, he doesn't say virtual reality, but what he says is...
You know where the term virtual reality was first said? It's Antonin Artaud. Yeah. Artaud, A-R-T-A-U-D, the mad surrealist and whack job in Paris, artist, poet, drug taker, went to the experimented with ayahuasca or those kind of drugs, ends up in a mental hospital, hero of the postmodernists and Severo Lautrange and Baudrillard. He's here, Baudrillard's hero. Artaud, he wrote a book on theater. And he coined virtual theater. I think he was referring to how could theater match Hollywood in the films and movies. So, uh-huh. Just 1938. Go ahead. Did you find it?
No. He just mentioned... No, maybe while somebody else is talking...
The fantasy life?
No. It's like straight up talking about coming up with some device that would...
Oh, yes. He is writing
like the holodeck.
In the 50s. That's right. He's like, in the 50s. Mm-hmm. He's talking about those technologies. Mm-hmm. Woody Allen, who was a fan of McLuhan, he probably got the idea of sleeper from McLuhan, because McLuhan wrote about, you put these things inside your brain and get a mental orgasm from them. Remember the Orgasmatron or something in Sleeper, Woody Allen's movie, 1971?
No, I don't like... I'm not a big fan of Woody Allen. I never got
him. Yeah, he's a later, he's too early, he's baby boomer, baby boomer.
But in 1984, don't they have the feelies and all that? Like, isn't there some of that?
No, that's Brave New World. Huxley,
okay.
Which many people think is closer to our reality than Brave New World. It's Huxley and Orwell, and McLuhan outdoes both of them. And, of course, he does it because of Wyndham Lewis and James Joyce, which is Thiel's point. Let's go back to the guys that actually inspired McLuhan that aren't even given a brief in any way, on this level.
Right.
So he says that these These magazines are heavily farced, mechanistic fantasies of a megalomaniac kind. And should Mr. Luce venture into the last sphere of human spontaneity and free intelligence, you know, aesthetics and art, he would inevitably feel urged to reduce that world to the kind of subhuman order he does understand. In a word, he would attempt to annihilate it for its own good. Anyway, that's pretty good. That could be extreme hippie talk in the late 60s or yippie talk, but nobody in 49 was doing that. Maybe Antonin Artaud or Gurdjieff was, but they were dead in 49. That's a good pattern. Gurdjieff dies in 49. Crowley dies in 48. Artaud may be dead around that time. All these guys who probably were mad and could see this coming, they didn't make it, so Marshall took the mantle, and he spelled it out. And it goes on and on in this article. It just nails everybody. It's a very extreme from their day, not from our point, but way ahead of its time.
Well, and I've never read Time, Life, or Fortune.
Yeah, you survived the Armageddon.
But still, the
you know what it would be today? Oprah Winfrey. It would be Oprah Winfrey, the News Hour, the McNeil-Lehrer News Hour. Oprah Winfrey, White House press conferences. Just take David Letterman. Take those people and write, substitute them for this. What is it? The guy, Jimmy Fallon or somebody, has a new Tonight Show I saw in the headline.
Jimmy Fallon, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, let's just do this. But the problem for Mr. Fallon is first to reduce the present role of entertainment to a simple pattern which could be reproduced daily without disturbing the existing affinities between his other three networks. That problem solved, he could probably buy up quite a crowd of internet companies for his new job. So then he goes, well, but Fallon's brain is not quite up for it. And we go on about how Oprah and Fallon and Letterman and Obama are heavily farced digital fantasies of a megalomaniac kind, and nobody will find either human dimension, human order, or human complexity in their shows or in their personality. See, just substitute those guys.
You could.
As a matter of fact, now here's the next thing. The Android meme does do that. The Android meme's got the whole spectrum. The Android meme's got Bob Dobbs and Frank Zappa and all these people criticizing the Android meme, and it's got people playing along with the Android meme like Ellen DeGeneres or Oprah. And the whole spectrum is run by the Android meme. The Android meme is the pen-ted manager, covers all the different opinions. The Android meme writes these kind of articles that McCoon wrote.
Mm-hmm.
So there's... See, the Android meme is what took over after McLuhan's prediction was realized by 1957.
Yeah.
So, you want to find some more quotes?
Yeah, I do. You know, I don't know. So we've, for the purposes of this discussion, we've laid out the fact that he's just ripping all these guys a new asshole. So we don't have to go into, like, tons more detail, but I do think the paragraph following the one that you just read is good, because now he's going to counterbalance that by talking about an independent artist. So just
right. This is what Norman Mailer goes on TV around this time and is freaked by the effect of being on TV. He is a writer, an independent, you know, avant-garde in mind. He can't take the corporate effect of media. And he becomes a friend of McLuhan eventually. So I'll let you read it. You might do a better job than me reading
okay.
The next paragraph or two.
For the independent artist and intellectual, the stereotype or insubordinate mechanism is death, the loss of perception and the abeyance of judgment. But because the areas in which perception is cultivated or even tolerated have been ever more rapidly circumscribed, the artist and intellectual have to turn to unmasking cliches and the mass mechanism of sensibility as part of the business of survival. Even in this role of the enemy of bloated inanities and glossy fakes, the artist and intellectual find the ultimate enemies of the human to be extremely elusive. The centers of political initiative today are as inaccessible as the accusers of a Kafka character.
Now, that's really important. That's what Foucault and these, the French theorists in the late 60s, early 70s start pointing this out. Marshall's saying it 20 years before them, that you can't find out who is running the conspiracy. Who is doing this? Man has merged with, the elites have merged with the machine. Loose has merged. That may be what he means when he says loose. Loose is not being cynically detached. He's actually identifying with the weary vacuum of his reader mass. He has an irremediable identity. So even the elites, the Trilateral Commission, you know, the people that Alex Jones rails against, they have merged with the machine as early as 1950. And this is what McLuhan's trying to point out, that you cannot find out who to blame the fingers at, point the blame at. And this, you're right, that this is why he says mechanical bride is the only strategy. You're looking at the maelstrom. You're going to get sucked down to it. You're doomed. Mm-hmm. And you got to figure out the retrieval factor or the tetrad factor or the thing that is going to bounce back up and then attach yourself to that. Do not attach yourself to the obvious survival mechanisms. They don't work anymore.
Right. And then he lays that out. So in the next pages, like page 149...
Now, Katie, I want to say this. As you hear this, a good student of Ion should notice this is what Ion is describing, what you're up against, and why Ion jumps all over the place in his strategies. He's being the barrel popping all over the place, presenting a quadriphenic example of what you have to do in your situation. Basically, the maelstrom story is relax and allow. Right? Allow yourself to be dragged down in the maelstrom. But that's a simple version. McLuhan has to point out the complexities, and so does Ion. So you should see that this is, that Ion is expressing what Ion, no. McLuhan was anticipating Ion's political statement when he's on a public media like Cashflow. He dumps it down and has a general mass media effect. He doesn't do that when he talks to you privately, one-on-one. That's a whole different thing. But in terms of dealing with the Android meme, Ion is, this is very Ionic. Ion says it's over for humanity. Gone. Mass die-off coming, right? You can't get out of your techno fix unless you use something like the drops.
Right. So it's relax and allow, and it's also learn to fire on all five cylinders.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, yeah, yeah.
Because the maelstrom is coming at you from, it's multiple environments.
Yes. Yeah. And merge, more and more merge into one thing, basically Obama. Obama, unfortunately, every president gets nailed for everything because it all implodes into the White House. So he causes every problem, every breakthrough, it's all around him. Even Gore thought he identified, he's like Henry Luce, he identified with that and thought he invented the Internet. And in a way, he was a figure funding this in the government in the 80s or whatever, and thought he had a say in the thing.
Yeah.
And everybody thought he was stupid, but he was partly true. And in the Croker Quadrant, he had become the Android meme. So the, yes, this is what's so... So perfect about Ion. He does manifest what we're talking about here.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Okay, so then in the next couple of pages, Marshall lays out the technique that Time, Life, and Fortune use to pull the wool over your eyes or whatever, to make you think that you're reading. I mean, everybody thinks about Life magazine pictures. I mean, that was going to be my point. I've never even read these magazines, and their archetypes.
You know them.
Resonate.
You know you have an image of them. Yeah.
Completely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a good point. They're Freudian archetypes. Jung and Freud did not get this. They did not know what the new archetypes were. That's why forget Joseph Campbell and Jung and Freud. It's silly. At the best. Chemical body limitations. So McLuhan's phrase for the new archetypes, the people that have these archetypes are homo boobians.
Right.
Homo boobians.
That's so funny. So the techniques that the magazines use, he's talking about he's now grouped them into one amalgam called TLF. So
yes.
Time, Life, and Fortune, it's TLF altogether.
Let's add that up. T is 2, L is a 12, so you got 122, and F is 6, so that's hexadic. That's 122 hexadic. anticipating the Android meme in its finer versions.
Wow.
You have to know how to read the Kabbalistic number signatures as well.
I'll just rely on you to do that for me.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
I'm doing everything else, so it's not.
I know, right?
Not a problem.
Yeah. Okay, so he says, first of all, they have a fast tempo, so they insist that the reader move rapidly, and pictures and ads produce an aura of supplemental awe as they just, like, come at you.
Yes.
Okay.
And
all
remember,
right.
this would be like a monk's studio, the slow pace it actually was compared to the way we are today. You know what I mean? But back then.
Right, where if you click on a video and it says 45 seconds, you're like, oh, God, I'm not going to sit here and watch it.
Give me a 25 second, or that's my limit. 22 seconds or out. I'm out of here. This is nanolife. Now, here's another thing to think about when you read this. This is a professor teaching freshmen English and other stuff in university. If the parents knew that the guy who wrote this was teaching their kids, I think they'd get their kid out of the class as soon as possible.
This is
a psychopath. And that's another point. McLuhan is the psychopathology of time and life. You know, there's no time and there's no life, according to Ion. That's psychopathology. McLuhan is being the environment, and he recognizes what's mirroring him, Mr. Luce's work.
Right. Well, and the other thing that's just coming to me in this very moment as I'm looking at this again, it was probably satire. He did that. What's that word?
Serio-comic.
Yes, that's it. Serio-comic. That's the word I'm looking for.
And this is Lewisian. This is Wyndham Lewis style. This is the kind of writing Lewis did.
Sure.
This is like Lewis wrote it in the 20s, and McLuhan says Lewis is right, and then he announces the game's over in 1949, 25 years after Lewis nailed it. Nobody knew it, and he nailed it. And the big book, the big manifesto of Lewis in 1926-27 is The Art of Being Ruled. It's not about how you can become ruler or how you can overthrow the rulers. You got to give up first. The art of being ruled. The beginning point, you know what I mean? Because it's 1984 in the 20s.
So whereas some people might read this article and think that he was like really mad while he was writing, like, pissed off.
Yeah, very bad. They took away my job. They killed my son. The Korean War hasn't happened. He lost everybody in the concentration camp, and he is pissed off. Yeah, that's right. But yet they would be amazed at how sanguine he was, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the phrase, sanguine.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know that, though.
No.
He is actually portraying Luce's mind. This is the attitude of Luce. Luce has killed people already, and he wants to kill more people. He wants to target the Greenwich Village and the intellectuals down there, He wants to go after the astute and kill them off.
Yeah. And that's the thing. I mean, we'll talk about Don Gill here in a minute, but all along as I've been reading, and especially when I read The Medium and the Light, when you think you're getting to know Marshall, he's got on a mask. He's operating by the code of the herdsman, big time.
That's right. Yeah, big time. And he's writing articles like this, like it's like another hidden identity. He's writing for an obscure magazine, Neurotica, that gets in trouble because it's like a porno magazine or something. You know, this is who he's writing for in New York City. This is where this article was published. And then the guy went to jail, I think, G. Legman. he's like a Larry Flint, Hustler magazine.
Oh, that's how funny.
Yeah, and here's this guy who goes to mass every day is writing this stuff. I mean, this is almost like a St. Francis Assisi or a St. John the Baptist. He's a prophet in the wilderness, yelling at everybody at the corner of Yonge and Bloor in downtown Toronto.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, he also fits the profile of a saint, somebody on the outskirts of in the wilderness, just condemning the cities, the Sodom and Gomorrah.
Right, but then he can go on Howard Stern and watch him go to the girl and stick in their clothes.
Yeah. Well, okay, I forgot to mention this. This is a really important anecdote. And In Understanding Media, he talks about a DJ in Toronto in the early 60s in the youth culture, David somebody, who would babble and make all these crazy sounds with his mouth, and an incredible DJ, forget his name. He's well known in Toronto. Well, I talked to him in the late, say, 79 or 80, for some reason came together and I got a chance to ask him. I said, what do you think of you being immortalized in Understanding Media? So this would be 15 years later, 64 to 79. And he would just be 24 years old or something in 64. He said, well, I actually talked to Marshall about that. He said, I met him and I said, you know that book, Understanding Media, you wrote? This was a casual statement by David to McLuhan. McLuhan says, I wrote that book? And David told me that it was, he didn't know what to do next. McLuhan stunned him. He was so stunned by it, he didn't pursue the fact that he was in the book. He got nowhere. He thought McLuhan was fucking insane.
Oh, my gosh.
Isn't that a great story? And it's true, he didn't write the book. The book is the act of speech, and the printed book itself complaining about the Android meme. What we're hearing here, it seems to be a complaint of a human being about the Time Life Fortune mega complex, but look at it as it's a magazine complaining about the domination of the loose empire. Don't think, because remember, Mechanical Bride is not people. He says it's a new kind of science fiction novel where the comics and the ads are the characters. So you would have to have a good understanding of McLuhan to know what character is writing this article. Just like what character responded to Dave the DJ when he said, I wrote that book? Isn't that incredible?
It is.
The greatest anecdote about McLuhan, because he knew he didn't write, it wasn't the Chemical Body guy that was doing this. He was acting a new kind of poetic theater. It was poetry and drama. And this is what Thiel beautifully spells out. And nobody in the McLuhan follower world can even handle Thiel. They don't even talk about him. They don't understand him. They don't believe it.
Yeah, You had told me a couple of weeks ago that you didn't think I would get the book or be able to. Maybe that's what you were talking about.
Well, you did say to me the other day you plan it's going to take about 6 months to read it. Did you say that?
No. I mean, we could do it fast if you want. I thought we would just take it like a chapter a week.
Oh, yeah. No, I want you to.
Not
yeah, because
take
it
so
is too.
Take up so much time. I mean, I could probably read it in a couple of days if I wanted to, but it is really, 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 it's so enjoyable. It's such an homage.
Yeah, I'm going to, go for the slow method.
And I need to go back and reread everything, too, because...
Yeah, it never stops. You don't stop reading McLuhan.
No.
The only books left. And he's just translating, updating Lewis and Joyce and Pound and Eliot. And so eventually you learn to read those guys. And then you see that they were pretty interesting. And that's why they're on my chart. And then you see the Android meme imitates those guys. That's what my chart shows.
Mm-hmm.
So it gets really complex, you know what I mean? And it's like studying being a detective on an amazing case. And to figure it out requires a lot of wit.
Well, I was telling some of this stuff to my sister because she listened to the last show.
Right.
And
what happened to my sister?
I know. So she was asking me some questions, and it was so cute. She was like, so wait, now this. And then what she said was, I feel like I'm in a labyrinth.
Yeah.
That's what she said, and she doesn't know Labyrinth of the Mind or anything. She's like, and then you go this way, and then you go, ooh, which way should I turn? Left or right. It was really precious.
That's my standard line, turn left to Greenland. which is what the Beatles said. Do you know that famous line? When they're, this is the anniversary of them being at Ed Sullivan, around the time they were interviewed. How did you find America? Turn left to Greenland.
Oh, you guys were writing about that on the chat tonight. I saw that blip across.
Oh, is that right?
Somebody
you mean
said
already
that.
Okay. I think I did.
Said that, I think.
I use that all the time. I'm just a bag of old cliches. I use the same lines. I don't have to think. They're all so astounding. And I was shocked that I'd forgotten the great McLuhan story that he denied writing Understanding Media. I forgot that one.
Yeah.
But back to your sister. Back to your sister. She,
yes,
Yeah, what's innocent? She's younger than you?
Yeah, just by a little bit.
See, so what you're getting, she is hearing thoughts that she's never heard before. You know what I mean? This is the point. Her mind has never heard these sentences, and they don't know where they are in relation to them. And so she's genuinely curious about where do these ideas come from? Where are they taking me?
She thought it was really interesting.
Well, that's good. That's a good sign.
It was good. She listened to the Alphabet versus the Goddess and two other friends. That was fun.
They listen to it in groups so that they can protect each other if they might have a breakdown.
No, they listen separately.
Oh, I thought you said they listen to it together.
No. Two other friends and my sister listen. Yeah.
In their own time, in their own little message groups.
Right. On their own little, with their own little earbuds.
And did she say what their reactions were?
Yeah, you know, everybody got kind of hung up on the Ellen Page comment when we talked about her. And so I clarified that, and that came up on my Facebook thread, too. There was like a 48 comment Facebook thread, and you had chimed in, too. And I think what I noticed, and when I clarified that with my sister, and I just was talking to her about how the chemical body is obsolete, so conversation about gender and sexuality really shouldn't be an issue, but it's the chemical body's last gasp. And so we make this like the biggest civil rights issue of our time because the chemical body knows that it's obsolete. So it's like, no, pay attention to me.
Yeah, Ellen DeGeneres has no interest in the human dimension. But they think, like Henry Luce with all these wonderful humans on the show and gay people, they must be wonderful people. They must be interested in humans. Let's just put her name in for Henry Luce. And I'm not singling her out because she's lesbian or anything. It can apply to anybody on a mass level. They don't know what the medium situation. They don't even know they're an after image. Now, I went on this woman. I never posted on her site before. And I know her from way back, and I don't know if I could bring it up, but they were all happy that Ellen came out, right? And they had the video where she's nervously announcing her new identity and all this. And I just went on there and I said, you cannot be gay today. You cannot be poor or rich. You can't be racist. That's all chemical body stuff. There are no chemical bodies. So nobody's being anything if they're talking in those terms. So there was no response, but that's what I spelled out. You can't.
If people don't understand that at all, it completely loses them.
Now, that's where they're living 100 years behind, see? They don't have the perceptual training, which is what McLuhan's talking about. It takes a while to get this perceptual training. So you're talking about Ellen Page. I'm probably going to play it tonight. Ian says 4 years ago, he was talking about the just people generally says, it's really cool to be a homosexual. This was 4 years ago among the younger kids. And he was talking about that. And so I was thinking that, so Ellen, she's famous in media culture, which is a murder. You wouldn't wish on anybody to be famous like she is. But they don't have any community, so she had to find a community. So she picked a cool community and declared herself a lesbian because that's the coolest one because that's part of the meme that's been going around for 10 years or whatever, however it's been in high school, and she's coming from backward Nova Scotia, right? So she's a bit behind this whole scenario. And you see her nervousness. She's very naive in all this situation.
A Canadian comes out,
right. A Canadian. And if Sky Goddess Sue is listening, she could even tell us personal anecdotes about Ellen's parents or something because they went to the school, you know, in Halifax. So that was that, and what was there was another one, but I can't remember. But there's two Ion comments that totally relate to this. I mean, is it cool to be a homosexual in high school today, in 2014?
Yes.
It still is?
Yes. And a really good example of that is the show Glee.
Yes. Oh, yeah, Carol. Carol loves that, or used to love the show. You don't do it anymore, Carol?
Yeah, I don't know if it's back on. I get totally disenchanted when Corey, the OD'd
That meant he wasn't real. Yeah. He thought he was a real human being up to this point. He was so happy and good in the show. And then he found he was just another zombie dupe like everybody else.
Yeah.
Karen's ideals were crashed once again.
Yeah, they were trying to be good role models for the youth of today, and they messed up.
I was in an office when that happened, and looking at People magazine, and described his girlfriend on the show, an actual girlfriend in life, going to the memorial but hiding in the limousine, and she was watching the celebration of him from a distance in the car. And that was an interesting the dilemma these people have when they're famous, you know. They at first it might be exciting, but eventually you just get so isolated. It's you got to be the prettiest perceptual person to survive it. They're being sucked into a maelstrom. And McLuhan says that back in the early 60s. He says, we kill a couple of teenagers every year. And he means the Cliff Richards, the Mick Jaggers, the John Lennon. You know what I mean? The stars of youth culture. That's what he means.
Yep.
James Dean.
And so now we're on a huge tangent, but let's just go there for a second. So Corey, who died on Glee of an overdose, it was heroin. After a long time clean, it was a relapse. And then Philip Seymour Hoffman, 2 weeks ago, 23 years clean, heroin, found him with a needle in his arm and, like, bags of heroin all over this apartment. And so what culture is saying is they're artists, therefore they're so sensitive, the world is just too, they can't handle the noise of the world, so they need heroin. So what I hear you saying is it's not because they're artists, it's because they're famous.
They're famous, right. They're not artists. And a real artist today would not even be known about. Or he'd be hidden away and have many disguises, so you wouldn't know. You could say the artists today are the ones who manage the Oprah show. Who's the one that Ian goes on about for Bill Lee of The View? The artists are the guys behind the scenes. He even says that in 1970, 71. He's quoted on CBC saying, feminism is women wanting total mobility, but and they will take over the obsolete institutions, you know, education, Vanity Fair magazine, you know, the Tina Browns and all this, take over all this old analog media. But what the men will do will move into surveillance and management on data pattern levels. Manage the big patterns. That's the Henry Kissingers, the Bill Lees, and the managers of what's his name, the guy who just Hoffman who just died. They're the artists. And
okay,
I don't mean
so
artists as a very smart person. The real artist that Powderham talked about and aspired to be was called a serious artist, where he would question the vast assumptions of the culture. They'd have big minds, you know, and they'd look at the big picture. Those kind of artists are run the CIA. You know, they're the person of interest. You ever watch that TV show? Ben is a modern artist. He's pretty skillful at what he does, and he's up against the Andor meme surveillance, blah, blah, blah. So it's not the images that our kids are taught in high school about art and all this bullshit, like your nieces. They think they're singers.
Mm-hmm.
They think they're still singing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
What do we have to go to their funeral? We've talked about them so much. When they die, we'll you'll have to say, Bob told us, but we didn't understand them.
I'll come pick you up in my car and take you, since you don't drive.
Yeah, right.
Okay, listen. So there's a tie-in on this artist thing too on page 151 of this, and we're skipping over, so we either we'll go back or we won't. I don't know. We'll see where this goes.
Yeah.
On the bottom of page 151, in the Psychopathology of Time and Life, it talks about artists, and he's alluding to Lewis. I know it. So it says, in a word, time, life, and fortune, the New Yorker can be tossed in with them, are the American Bloomsbury, our psychological bureaucracy inhabited by well-paid artist apes.
That's Lewis. Yeah, Lewis writing about the Bloomsbury Group in 1930, the novel was The Apes of God. He stole this from Lear. This sentence was stolen from Lewis.
He totally did. He stole it.
Yeah.
So then it goes on. It says, in America, art must pay off before it can be respectable or even interesting. And the artist ape must here assume the air of executive or engineer in order to circulate or prosper. So that's
very interesting in relation to Theo time with the poet-engineer thing. That's very interesting. Yeah, you were going to say? Go ahead.
I was just going to say, so that's the kind of artist that the guy who played Corey on Glee. And
that was the other thing Ion said. You know, the homosexual. And the only employment is to, he says, make up an identity about yourself and get on an American reality TV show. That's the only way. And he said, and become famous in the McLuhan way. He cites McLuhan. But that's the only thing. Now, they think that they're being artists. Bring out your talent, you know, and go on American whatever that thing
Idol.
Is, and Idol, and present yourself, and then you might get some money for a few weeks. That's not the artist. And the Bloomsbury people, Tina Brown and all these idiots who, or even the guy who runs Rolling Stone, or what's a youth thing going on today? What are they? Well, there isn't any. The manager of BlackBerry, or Steve Jobs, whoever took over from him, who are making great gadgets for 10-year-olds, they're the artist apes today. They're the engineer inventor apes. They're the Bloomsburys who are just asking people to merge with the latest technologies. That was McLuhan's
right.
criticism against Andy Warhol. Pop art was tribal art, but it asked people to merge, whereas Marshall said, I'm not doing pop art. I'm critiquing and showing you how to survive the advertising world, the pop art world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So how would you tell people to survive? The only survival, once you know about RNA drops, is our stuff. So that's why I can say, well,
right.
we're the only artist engineer around. If you believe
right.
what we do and can do, we're the only solution.
Well, and then you can do some media ecology, and you can manage the maelstrom, and you can do the code of the herdsman and put on your mask. And
well, I do it every day
right?
on dupes, on phone calls, on whatever things I have to do communicating with people, and then on the shows. That's what I do.
I
wear these masks. Here's McLuhan. Here's his solution. In 1949. And he said, so the process of renewal can't come from above, which is, that's Ionic. You know, the priests, the church, the scientists, the government, the mafias, they're not going to renew you. They're going to maybe help you cope, and then you'll get removed and die on the golf course or something, right? So how are you going to have the renewal? It has to come from below or not from above. It can only take the form of reawakened critical faculties, the untrancing of millions of individuals by millions of individual acts of the will, psychological decentralization, a merely provisional image of how it might, not how it should, occur. He's very smart. He knows that you don't dictate one way to it. Right? You just suggest one thing, but it's not the only way. A merely provisional image of how it might, not how it should, occur, could be formed by supposing every mechanical agency of communication in the world to be suspended for 6 months. No press, no radio, no movies, just people finding out who lived near them, forming small communities within big cities. It would be agony. All psychological drugs cut off. No encapsulated thoughts or melodies. To say that anything like this could never happen, or that it should never happen, or that it should never be allowed to happen, is a remark worthy of those mesmerized practical men like Luce, who are efficiently arranging for the obsequies or funeral of our world's mind and body alike. If something like this doesn't happen, it is quite plain what will happen. And he gave up 5 years later, no, 10 years later, and joined the, he offered to take over the corporate global theater because no one else was qualified. He knew the artist had to leave the ivory tower and go to the control tower. They offered to do that, but nobody took him up on
it. And then Steele talks about the artist, which I think he stole this from somebody, too, or came from somewhere else, but the artist as the antenna.
That's Ezra Pound. The antenna of the race.
Pound?
Yeah, there were two quotes.
Yeah.
The one from Pound is the artist is the antenna of the race. The other one, the McLuhan user from Lewis, who said, the artist is the only one who writes a detailed history of the future because he knows exactly what's going on in the present.
Mm-hmm.
He knows the present is the future. You know, the future, people think the future, what's happening to them now, they can't see it. They take another 10, 15 years before they see it, and they'll say, oh, that was in our future. No, it was in your present. So those two,
right.
those are the two main artist perceptual rules that McLuhan had. Then he says, so the next paragraph, the only practical problem which remains today is that of restoring human dimensions so that a merely human order can become relevant and practical once more. Look at this. There's no human order possible. It is obvious that, humbly envisaged, the machine could have helped to do this, but any rational hope in that quarter is now gone. The machine is power, and practical politics mean quite simply that the machine must assume increasingly its most powerful form. The shape and rational form of man is now irrelevant. See, chemical body's gone. The will of all society has persisted in this direction for more than a century. Enthusiastic abdication on behalf of the machine. Eager embrace of man when deloused of his humanity by technics. That is the impatient wish, the wider hope embedded in the loose publications examined here. So repeat that. The loose people are for enthusiastic abdication on behalf of the machine, even though it's already happened, McLuhan's saying. Eager embrace of man when deloused of his humanity by techniques. Now, all those things have already happened, and loose is presenting an afterimage of that analog phase of technoculture. An afterimage. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, there's still humans, and this mass mind loves to look at these images
mm-hmm.
of what could have been.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, then by the 70s and 80s, it becomes, in the baby boomer world, that all the rock guys are drugged out, dead, killed, Janis Joplin, they all get wiped out. You know what I mean? And
mm-hmm.
they're supposed to be savvy
mm-hmm.
adults.
Mm-hmm. It's true. And this, what you just read was the end of the article, so we can move on. Although I would like to just, I want to bring up just a couple other little teeny things in here, if that's okay.
Yeah.
I was going to cover the, there's more that he says that time and life does besides the tempo. Let me just mention these. This is interesting. In addition to going fast in tempo with the pictures and all that, they assume, now I'm on 149.
Okay.
At the bottom. I numbered these. So the paragraph above it, one of the most obvious facts then is their tempo. Okay, so we covered that. Then go to the last paragraph. Then it's the godlike heights of observation. So they take those fantastic pictures from godlike heights of observation straight up. And then it appeals to every Dagwood's want to, like, scale Mount Everest, but they can't because they're at home with a sandwich.
So they go there by virtual reality, by a photographer.
Right. Yep.
Which is the beginning of virtual reality in 1839. Photograph.
Yeah. Yep. Then the third thing is they have the assumption that people are funny. And he mentions Lilliput in there, too. So that's going to appear later on in Mechanical Pride, too.
Right.
So there's that. And then...
he wrote an article on Lewis in 1944 saying that Lewis, when Lewis was Lemuel in Lilliput.
Mm-hmm.
Lemuel among the Lilliputians.
Right. And then he talks about the prose, too. So it's a combination of the pictures and the prose. I think they're getting this, like, fabulous experience, but it's fake. And it's even faker now. You know?
Well, this is the issue. The problem is it's not fake. It's new nature. It's evolution, techno-evolution, that people don't have the right concepts of what it is. They might say, oh, this is not real, and sort of say, I got to put up with all these people involved with fantasy. No, McLuhan's not saying that this is fantasy. Now, some of these words here are saying that. He would have to clean up what he's saying here. He calls it farce mechanistic fantasies of a megalomaniac kind. But I think he knows it's new nature because he's reacting in a conventional way.
Isn't that Vito? Isn't that Vico? New nature? Is that Vico?
No, he did the new
Italian
science.
New science. Okay, never mind.
Yeah.
I thought I remembered something.
Vico is 1700. Vico
1700. Yeah, well, I thought maybe some of his Vico influence was coming in, but I was wrong. Anyway.
You were a little immature. See, you're grabbing at the patterns, but you haven't got them all in sophisticated.
No, I don't. That's okay.
You know, for you, this whole thing is snow, whereas I can see the 50 kinds of snow. You only just see snow at this point.
You can see the flakes, I'm sure.
Yeah, too. Yeah.
Among, yeah.
Well, there's a lot of Daffodil song about the flakes. Flakes everywhere.
I'm going to go into a parallel reality where I see the There's some kinds of snow, and then when I wake up in the morning, I'll be right there with you, Bob.
Yeah, that's what you're doing. By reading these books, you're going into parallel worlds and rehearsing this whole stuff to present yourself in the real world of Saturday night.
I am.
So you spend the whole week in parallel worlds.
I did.